Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. This time, I'm going to be talking about the 2018 Retro Hugo winner, Robert Heinlein's Beyond This Horizon, which was awarded for the year 1943. And my guest is none other than multiple Hugo winning author, David Brin. Hi there, David.
Well, hello, Seth, and hello to all your listeners, and hello to the future, because yesterday, today was the future.
Correct. It's a great pleasure to have you. I really appreciate you coming on. I have a hard time imagining that people listening to this podcast won't know, you know, who you are, but how about a little bit of background on your history?
Oh, well, you know, I'm kind of an old fart. I was born 6 weeks into the first half of the 20th century in 1950, and I grew up in L.A., Los Angeles. I went to the same high school as Ray Bradbury, 20 years apart, and near Hollywood, so I got to see all the spoiled stuff. But also got an appreciation for how Hollywood is putting out the greatest propaganda system ever seen by any human civilization. And I imagine we'll want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. At least you indicated so. I always knew I'd be a writer, because I come from a family of writers, it was always my hobby. But I looked around me, most science fiction authors actually are more imbued in history, human history, than in science. Only 10% of us are scientifically trained. Though some of the best science, hard science fiction, is done by former English majors like Nancy Kress and Kim Stanley Robinson and the late Greg Bear, who understood that you can understand science verbally if you just buy scientists' pizza and beer. It's a great trick. Yes. Very, very cheap consultancy. But anyway, I was imbued in history, and I looked at human history and was utterly appalled and so amazed that we finally were making a civilization that cared about what was actually true. And so I wanted to be part of that. So I went to Caltech for my undergraduate, where I started writing novels part-time. I went to UCSD and got my PhD in astrophysics. And today I consult with NASA's Innovative and Advanced Concepts program. So I keep my hand in science. But along the way, I started publishing these stories. And my second novel took off like a stratospheric balloon, a temporal reference to this last week. And so civilization clearly wanted me to write. So all the scientists I've known have had artistic sidelines. I thought writing would be my artistic sideline. Turns out that science is my sideline. So I think that brings us kind of up to date, except that I am happily married with three adult kids, and I live here. So, you know, life ain't as much of a bitch as it was for my ancestors.
I feel like there is a stereotype from non-scientists who assume that, you know, the nerds that they know are, you know, that that's all consuming, that there aren't other side habits that go with it. I like that you brought that up, that you know, you thought that writing would be your side gig, but it turned out that science is the side.
Well, at Caltech, well, I was told by my father that he took me to see Einstein play the violin when I was three. I have no memory of it. But that's certainly consistent with what I saw when I was an undergraduate at Caltech and then in graduate school, that all the best scientists I ever met had artistic sidelines that they pursued at an almost and sometimes professional level.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that scientists are automatically smarter? Or does it mean that if you are a polymath and you can do both art and science and you love both art and science, you have a realization that science has to be your day job?
Right.
Because science has to be done in a disciplined manner, in collaboration with others, using instrumentalities, even if it's just a chalkboard. And your art can be put off to next week or can be put off to the weekend. And so it's not that scientists are smarter, it's just that those who can do both tend to make science their day job because right. their other passions can be done on a less rigid temporal schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I don't follow a very rigid temporal schedule now that I'm now that I'm more an artist than a scientist.
Right. I'm an engineer by trade, and when I was in college, I was taking a motion control class. And at some point, the prof asked, does anybody here like to do crossword puzzles? And there were maybe 25 of us in the class. It was a small private college. And I was the only one who raised my hand. And he looked at me and he said, well, are you sure you're in the right major? And I thought, well, does nobody else here have an outlet for non-techo stuff? Because I've always liked to, you know, read and not just, you know, science fiction, but read and many different fields. And it was, to me, always a way of getting away from the drudgery of some of the technical stuff that I was doing.
Right, right. And this is one reason why it's particularly vexing that all sides in our current phase of the U.S. Civil War, and I include the side that is less insane, that I politically support, nevertheless, both extrema in this participate in, I believe, the biggest prejudice in our current society, and that is anti-nerdism.
Mm.
The left feels they can sneer at nerds because the nerds are privileged, and you sure. can only vouchsafe courtesy to the underprivileged. And the right attacks nerds almost relentlessly, because they say those terrible words, sir, that's not true.
Right.
And that is why today's right has gone after even former heroes like the FBI, the intelligence agencies, the U.S. military officer corps. They're all those people who won the Cold War and the War on Terror. They're all enemies now mm-hmm. because they say those terrible words. That's not true. Right. And that, of course, is one of the major things about history, that we stumbled into what Adam Smith recommended, what Thomas Jefferson recommended, but only partly fulfilled. And that is the notion that if you level the playing field enough, oligarchs can no longer have their way at whim.
Mm.
And they can't have critics killed. And that was the great catastrophe across almost all human civilizations. 99% of human civilizations that had agriculture quickly settled into a pyramidal structure with a few tough males at the top taking everyone else's women and wheat. And the first priority that they had was to kill all the critics, anybody who criticized them. And that, of course, led to the horrible litany of errors that is called human history.
Right.
Because humans are all delusional. Even a good king is delusional. I'm delusional. Science forces me to admit that. And when I won't let science force me to admit it, my wife forces me to admit it. And so I slowly came to realize that the great trick that enabled us to finally break out of feudalism and 6,000 years of horrible error was to flatten things enough so that nobody can evade criticism. Criticism is the only antidote to error. That's my aphorism that spread for a while there, Cito Kate. And that led to my 1998 book, The Transparent Society, Will Technology Make Us Choose Between Freedom and Privacy? Came out the same year as Kevin Costner's movie of my novel, The Postman.
Mm.
He brought it out on Christmas weekend, 1997, sending out an email to all concerned, even me, and the author doesn't rate, sent out an email, and yes, there were emails in 97, saying, we haven't made this Christmas release date. Our only real competition is James Cameron's silly remake about a sinking boat. Probably one of the greatest epic fails of movie timing in the history of the world.
Right.
Going back to Roman times, So anyway, yeah. So this civilization that enabled me to, you know, live comfortably, have kids, all those things, is one that I'm very loyal to. And I know it's different from all the others that came before. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how and why it's different. And I believe that's the case because we developed a new propaganda, and it's mostly pushed by Hollywood. And it pushes five themes that were never promoted to young people in any other culture. And it's because of these Hollywood themes that a lot of the despotic regimes in the world don't like to allow in Hollywood films. The number one theme in every film you've ever enjoyed is suspicion of authority. There has to be an authority figure that is foiling or thwarting or hurting the protagonist and maybe a lot of other people. It could be chomping aliens, or it could be a nosy mother-in-law. But there has to be an authority figure to be defied. Other themes that are pushed pretty relentlessly in Hollywood films are tolerance and diversity and eccentricity. Almost always in the first 5 minutes of the film, the protagonist exhibits some eccentric trait. And here's the thing, it doesn't have to be your eccentric trait. The audience member bonds with the protagonist because there is a vulnerable eccentric trait. And therefore, that audience, that protagonist, they are someone to sympathize with. Now, one other society in human history that propagandized generations of its children to have as their most natural reflex in the world the criticism of society's flaws and especially its leaders.
Right.
It's never happened before. And our children so take it for granted, as I did when I was a hippie, that we don't stop and look in the mirror and say, huh, I was trained to be this way. I suckled these habits from the teat of a society that wanted its mother's milk for its children to be suspicion of authority and eccentricity. What civilization would design a propaganda system like that? I finally concluded we must have done it ourselves, because we reward movie makers who have those themes,
right,
with box office receipts. That has to be the reason. And I get into that in my latest nonfiction book, which is called Vivid Tomorrows, Science Fiction in Hollywood. And I get into why I think that we are alive today because of Hollywood science fiction, because of thought experiments and warnings.
Yeah, I did want to pick up on that. And I haven't been able to get all the way through the book, but one of the early chapters is about the self-preventing prophecy, where we have this, you know, going back to the Cold War, all these novels about dealing with the aftermaths of nuclear war or other apocalypses. And it's essentially a way for us to put ourselves in that situation and realize we need to prevent it. And that's fascinating.
Right. The self-preventing prophecy carries out what my friend Ray Bradbury said, and that is, I'm not here to predict the future. I'm here to prevent it. And so some of his books, like Fahrenheit 451, are cited regularly, vehemently, by people who often don't even understand what the book was about.
Right.
Actually, almost no one seems to get that book is set in a democracy, not a tyranny. The people chose, through political correctness, to suppress books because they offend people.
Yeah.
But it was a self-preventing prophecy because people were girded more against repression of argument in books. Some of the granddaddies of self-preventing prophecies were actually about despotism, like George Orwell's 1984, Now, that's a real despotism. Mm-hmm. The irony being that Orwell was a man of the left, but most of his novels and criticisms of potential despotism were about communism, even though in his nonfiction, he railed against against capitalism. Very interesting fellow. But, you know, 1984 girded millions of people with metaphors like Big Brother. Mm-hmm. And the big difference between a decent, moderate person of the left and a decent, moderate person of the right, kind of a rare species these days, is which direction you think is conspiring to become Big Brother.
Right.
I mean, a liberal person thinks it's most likely that Big Brother is coalescing among oligarchs, aristocrats, Davos, trillionaires, CEOs.
The 1%.
Yeah, and faceless corporations. A person of the right who's sincere is concerned that it's happening with snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats.
Right.
If you express it that way, then the proper answer is, duh. You're both right. All of those are potentially dangerous power centers. And if we weren't goaded right now into being at each other's throats, we might calm down enough to say, you know, I think you have a point about my elites. So I'll negotiate with you something to keep them on a choke chain if you'll negotiate with me about keeping yours on a leash. That process called negotiated politics has been the objective to destroy across the last 25 years of politics. It's not any particular agenda, not even the war against nerds. It's the destruction of our ability to negotiate through a pragmatic, filthy, pragmatic art called politics. And that has been virtually destroyed. Our enemies have succeeded in their principal goal. Anyway, the self-preventing prophecy, yeah, there's others like you mentioned nuclear war. We probably exist because of Testament, war games, fail-safe, on the beach, all of them warnings that the retired military officers later admitted they took very seriously. The China syndrome about nuclear power girded up the safety procedures. My late friend Harry Harrison's Make Room, Make Room, which was turned into Soylent Green.
Yes.
Which recruited millions of environmentalists. It was probably playing when Greta Thunberg was conceived.
Probably.
All right.
So I do want to move on to sort of pivot to talking about Beyond This Horizon and about Heinlein. And this is always a fascinating thing to me, to talk to a more modern science fiction author about some of those golden age authors and what the influence was there. Because this was Heinlein what you were reading when you were younger?
Well, yeah, I grew up a little more on Bradbury than Heinlein. My actual arrival at science fiction was really not usual. My compadres, my fellow killer bees, Greg Bear and Greg Benford, also killer V, Werner Vinge and Rob Sawyer, they all got into this when they were young through fandom. They participated in fanzines. They read all of Heinlein and all of that, all the juveniles. I had read a couple of Heinlein's juveniles, a couple of his adult books, some Asimov, a fair amount of Bradbury. My biggest education in science fiction when I was growing up was Judith Merril's annual Best Of book, which I looked for. I looked for every year in the local rotating little thing in the at the local pharmacy, and her Best Of collection was what gave me my best education in science fiction. I never attended a science fiction convention until after my Bantam bought my first novel.
Okay.
So anyway, Beyond This Horizon is, in my opinion, Heinlein's greatest novel. It followed his usual pattern of lots of vivid action, adventure in the first half. And then he gets to the first half, or maybe the 60th percent percent point through the book, and then kicks back and says, okay, I gave you your entertainment. Now I'm just going to talk for a long time.
Right. The blather half.
Yeah, the blather half.
Your blog posts.
Yeah. And usually that's not as good. I mean, look at the wonderful quasi-fantasy novel Glory Road, and I refer to it a bit in my novel Glory Season. Wonderful adventure, and then about 60% of the way through, it's just turns into this blab fest following the protagonist when he enrolls at Caltech, of all things.
Mm.
Well, Beyond This Horizon follows that. And by the way, Heidlein and I would have been great collaborators, because when I teach writing, I say, retype the first three pages of a bunch of Heinlein novels. He knew how to get you started so well. His hooks were fantastic. His characters shot out of the page and grabbed you by the collar and said, pay attention to me. I have a great story to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he taught the lesson that you should start out ideally with things that are surprising and unsettling that the main character takes for granted. I think one of them started, I was late for school. I grabbed my lunch and dashed out the door without a monster umbrella. Damn it, the Gazakstaplus were raining again. I had to slog through them all the way to the bus stop. How can you not want to read more?
Right.
And it was because the character took it for granted, this reign of Gazakstaplus, that really made it interesting. So I have trouble starting novels. I'm having a terrible time right now. But boy, do I end them well. The last third of my novels, I will not even try to be humble. Everybody says it. They are just, you know, you cannot put them down to feed the cat. You cannot put them down to go to work, to feed your children. So anyway,
you're okay with that responsibility.
Yes, yes. It's a sadomasochistic relationship. Okay. I tell my students, you've been in the masochist side of the relationship all your reading life. Now it's your turn to get some licks in.
Nice.
So I'm going to read to you the greatest hook I've heard lately. It's got a semicolon in the middle. I was 9 when my words saved a man's life. It wasn't until later that my words killed him.
Ooh.
Now that's a great hook.
Yeah.
Written by my wife, Cheryl Brin, in her novel, A Melody of Memory, and you can find it via my website. It's a wonderful novel, very feminine, tragic, and yet triumphant toward the end. But in any event, Beyond This Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond This Horizon followed the standard Heinlein pattern. Lots of action, adventure in the first half, then a lot of blah, 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 blah in the second half. Except for this one thing. The action-adventure part at the beginning, which was, he was talked into doing this whole an armed society is a polite society code duello gun thing by John W. Campbell. It's utter crap.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get past that stuff, the second half is so brilliant, blah, 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 such brilliant blah, 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 that it's beyond belief. Heinlein may be known 200 years from now for his suggestion, offhand suggestion in the book about genetic engineering. So
right.
I got one of those messages from one of my readers saying that my short story, Chrysalis, will probably be what I'm most known for 100 years from now, because he says that I'm probably right about my hypothetical explanation for cancer.
Wow.
I have a highly unusual proposed explanation for why cancers are so organized, as if they're plotting against us.
Mm.
So I got one of those. And that story, called Chrysalis, is in the recently published Best of.
Nice.
Woo, woo.
We're not recording video, but it's for my benefit at least.
Oh, man. Oh, geez. Well, I think I need to explain to the audience then that there were several times when I held up book covers. So I instead will supply links.
There we go.
And I'm sorry, the Wii U was when I was moving I held up a picture of Greg Bear and Greg Benford. You should have told me earlier, Seth.
you were rolling. I couldn't interrupt you.
All right. I'm going to put some things in messages.
Okay. I mean, I do want to talk about, I feel like the second half of the book probably doesn't work without setting it up because the civilization is set up, the kind of problem, and the book starts off and it makes it seem like it's going to be, at least to me, what I was expecting was, okay, we're going to have Hamilton Felix embedding with this terrorist group. And that's going to be the plot of the novel. And then it completely dispenses with that in the first half and shifts to something completely different.
Well, that's because he had given John W. Campbell what he asked for.
Right.
You know, this whole, you know, an armed society is a polite society. Well, that might be true someday. I mean, if you had 10,000 people, 10,000 years of people, short-tempered people shooting each other, then the long-tempered people would eventually be genetically, you know, more serene and polite.
Right.
Unfortunately, we evolved. We evolved up to about 12,000 years ago, and what we had was sticks and pokey things. Mm-hmm. And so, if you lost your temper, a bunch of other people could grab your arms, drag you outside, sit you on the cobblestones, and say, "Get over it."
Right.
That's not the case now.
Right.
And we're experiencing that.
Yeah. Certainly, we are an armed society, unfortunately, and it does not make us more polite. It just means that stupid arguments turn into people getting killed.
Right. No, the killers are being removed from the gene pool. They are removing themselves from the gene pool, but with extraordinary inefficiency. Some of them have already procreated, and meanwhile, you have anywhere from 5 to 20 victims who were removed from the gene pool.
Right.
You know, it's just a stupid way of looking at things. So in any event, but the second half of Beyond This Horizon is well worth wading through the first half. I mean, the first half is, I mean, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it moves just fine.
It moves along. Heinlein knows what he's doing.
And it is a good hook.
Oh, yeah, he knows what he's doing. But then in the second half, he soft pedals the whole gun thing by saying, oh, my gun has been in its holster for the last 20 years. Right. I can't remember the last time I saw anybody shoot anybody else. So, you know, he just segues over to genetic engineering and how to maintain a human society that doesn't go nuts giving its children feathers and tails, mm-hmm. and yet allows its knowledge to gradually and in an eclectic way allow us to sort of have the natural kids that we might ordinarily have, who just happen to be stronger and fitter and sturdier, moving forward a bit. Mm-hmm. So it was. It's a very interesting novel, and I really only met Heinlein once. As I said, Ray was a friend of mine. Arthur Clarke, I was in the same room with him several times, but he was all there were crowds around him, but we exchanged letters. So he knew who I was, and I knew him. I can claim he was sort of a friend, and I helped establish the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination at UCSD. But it's Asimov who I quasi collaborated with. Mm. I showed the image of Foundation's Triumph. I suppose I could find that link as well and send it to you. Mm-hmm. But Foundation's Triumph is my novel that I wrote in Asimov's voice, trying to channel him. And it was part of what's called the Second Foundation Trilogy. The Killer Bees, Greg Bear, Greg Benford, and myself, were asked to do a trilogy sequel. cleaning up a lot of Isaac's loose ends. Well, Greg Baer wrote a, Benford wrote a relatively non-Asimovian adventure novel set when Harry Seldon was young. Greg Baer perfectly captured the voice of Asimov's murder mysteries in a very, very tightly woven murder mystery set in Harry Seldon's middle years called Foundation and Chaos. And we collaborated loosely, but these are standalone novels in which I was behooved to relate to what they had done. And I wrote Foundation's Triumph set in the last 2 weeks of Harry Seldon's life, in which he has his greatest adventure. After the Empire has taken all the exiles from Terminus, all the scientists and all the encyclopedists, and sent them off to Terminus, after they're gone, after Harry leaves his final message and says, "As for me, I am finished," well, those are the words that begin my novel.
Nice.
"As for me, I am finished." And then he slumps in his wheelchair and he thinks it's all over. And someone comes to him with a piece of information. And I tied together everything. I tied together the plot elements that he was talking about in his last novels. I tied in obscure Asimov books like Pebble in the Sky, the Currents of Space, The Stars Like Dust. Boy, he used to have great, great titles. And of course, Caves of Steel and Naked Sun and all of those. So I wove together just about everything, and Janet Asimov was very pleased. That was my interface with, and I brought Isaac's universe around full circle. And as some of you know, the motif of a circle coming around was very powerful for Isaac. And I brought the plot elements that he had been talking about. I tried to follow what I thought were his clues. And I brought the entire Foundation universe back around full circle. So that was, those were my brushes with greatness. When I was a grad student, before my first novel was published, I took a class, writing class from Ursula Le Guin. Let's see, who else? Steve Barnes also went to LA High School, and he was 1 year behind him. I taught him everything he knows. Everything. he smiles. He's such a gentleman. He smiles and looks at me with indulgent affection, and I can feel my head being patted. Whatever you say, David. Whatever you say. That's the sign of a self-assured guy. He's a brilliant writer. So those are some of the people I have personal connections with.
Nice. The kind of going back to the first half of the novel of Beyond this Horizon, I do enjoy the hook of it where Hamilton Felix realizes that here we're in a post-scarcity society. There's a universal basic income. You know, people work if they want to, but no one's happy. And I think that's a good way to start.
I don't know that I'd go that far. I think that most people are portrayed as fairly content. It's just that you get extra money if you are a control natural who has done no genetic engineering and you want to have natural babies. So this society is wise enough to want to keep a substantial population that has had none of this genetic engineering done to elevate their children. And still, the control natural population is just declining because... Who wants to have a kid who's going to have a congenital illness?
Right.
I love this a scene that answers the lazy slurs on Heinlein that he was some kind of right-wing fascist.
Right.
What he was someone like me, a contrarian. Whoever he was with, he loved to argue with them. So when he wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, it was this revolutionary piece against rigid society and against rigid sexual norms and in favor of being able to take drugs that you wanted. And when the hippies showed up to worship Heinlein, well, they became the people who were in his presence. So he was irritated by them. And, you know, in the 60s, I guess it was naturally to be irritated by some of the finger waggers. But in Beyond This Horizon, there's this plot element, this guy from the 1920s who was somehow frozen in time.
Right.
And they finally thaw him out, you know, in the 23rd century when the novel is set. And he's going on a tour of this society. And he sees that lots of people have restaurants and competitive businesses. And he says, you know, all right, so everything's competitive. Socialism has gone to hell. That's great. And his tour guide looks puzzled for a little while. And then he gets this shocked expression on his face. And he says, hold it. Are you suggesting that I actually believe people should be allowed to starve? Oh, my God. Or what kind of people do you think we are? Naturally, all food is free.
Right.
Food and shelter are free. Unless you want to compete by doing gourmet stuff. Mm-hmm. Sure, there are gourmet restaurants, but the free cafeterias all serve wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of people do you think we are?
Right.
And that was Heinlein for you. I mean, he believed that human needs should be handled socialistically and that Adam Smith was preaching that we should have the maximum number of skilled, confident competitors. And they should then be fed into a market competing system because that's the cornucopia of wealth. Hmm. That's the way civilization has advanced. But you don't get the maximum number of competitors if there are poor children.
Right.
I've estimated that 80% of liberal programs could be justified through capitalistic justifications following Adam Smith, because they are about ensuring that all poor children get the nutrition, freedom, and education they need to then take on Elon Musk.
Right.
It's extremely frustrating to me that liberals never make that argument. They always use the moralistic argument. Mm-hmm. When most of the liberal programs are perfectly justifiable in capitalistic terms.
Right.
How in the world can you maintain a civilization that believes in competition when you're wasting talent? You need to be socialistic in ways that create the maximum feedstock to then shove everybody confidently, knowing that they can fall back and come back again, into a giant maelstrom of joyful competition. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the American right today has completely forgotten Adam Smith.
Well, yeah, and on the right, I think there's a notion that isn't spoken out loud most of the time. Well, if we bring the standard of living up, then they won't vote for us.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
The problem is more useful to them.
I think that the poor are not the real enemy owners of the right. Mm-hmm. They use racism and classism and sexism to rile up Confederate ground troops. Mm. But if you take a look at any given week on Fox, races and genders are very seldom attacked. Mm-hmm. What's attacked all the time are nerds. Every nerd, every nerd profession, every fact-using profession from science and teaching and journalism, civil servants, the Intel FBI military officer corps who won the Cold War and the War on Terror, all of them, medicine, law, they're all under attack. Why? Because these groups, the nerds, do have power.
Right.
They have power to thwart oligarchy. That's why they're the enemy. Hmm. Think about it. How in the world are the powerless a threat to the powerful? Hmm. By definition, the powerful don't have to worry about the powerless. The powerless hurt more. They're in more pain, yeah. I mean, the scientists and the intel agents, they have houses You know, mm-hmm. civil servants have homes. They're not starving. So they're not in pain. But the reason why they're under attack is because they do have power. Mm-hmm. They have the power to thwart a return to feudalism. And then I've done something I promised myself I wouldn't do, and that's gone explicitly political. But, you know, what are we doing? Every generation of Americans has to fight for the great experiment.
Yeah.
And every generation of Americans experiences civil war. I think we're in a particularly nasty one. We're in phase 8 of the American Civil War. And I'll even include a link to that in a message to you, so you include that if you want.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
There is a notion in the book that it reminded me a little bit of Brave New World, where there's the notion that when you're proposing scientific research in the society, you don't necessarily want, you know, it might be harder to get funding for peer scientific research because it generally has the annoying effect of improving, you know, standard of life and having cost savings and life savings down the line. And I think they kind of feel like, no, we're good enough on that front. So if you have something that that won't save labor, you know, that will still allow people to do work, then.
Well, it's not so much that they want to hold on to poverty. No, what they're saying is labor saving devices in and of themselves aren't necessarily the be-all. And
right.
We see this in Kurt Vonnegut's wonderful book, Player Piano, his first novel and his most explicitly just a science fiction novel, whereas he got all artsy-fartsy after that, and I shouldn't complain because I'm a huge Vonnegut fan. But in Player Piano, there's this scene where this barber is being interviewed, and he's gotten rich because he's created a haircutting machine that can do any kind of haircut. And he said, for 20 years, I've been worried that someone could make a haircutting machine and make me obsolete. And every night I would go home and figure out how somebody could solve the next problem. And then I would reassure myself by saying, yeah, but then there's this other thing I do. Mm-hmm. Finally, after 20 years of it, I got the thing working. So, you know, look, you know, now we're in an era of ChatGPT and the right. art generated by computers. Exactly 5 years before 2022, I predicted that 2022 would be the year of the first robotic empathy crisis. And Newsweek noticed, and so they asked me for an op-ed, which came out a few months ago, and I just added it to the things you can put below, where I talk about how, you know, we're going to be overwhelmed by these things, and they are going to convince a great many people. And in the long run, it's not going to matter when they cross that threshold. What's going to matter is how we handle it with our value system. Now, Seth, I'm afraid I have some things I have to do, so I'm going to have to cut this short unless you had a last question that you really, really wanted to get to.
I mean, I did think it was interesting in the second half, you get into not only the genetic engineering part, but the great research into life beyond life, right?
Well, that last part actually inspired the last third of my novel, Kiln People, K-I-L-N, Kiln People. It's set in a future where, like Heinlein, the cool thing has been given to everybody. It's not restricted to the rich because that makes for a real cheap novel, a cheap story. You see that a lot in Hollywood movies. No, the cool thing in the future in Kiln People is that anybody can buy these cheap clay golem blanks and put on a headset and imprint them with your soul as well as your memory. Mm. And they slide into your home kiln and are baked and activated. And so they come out, they're Kiln People. And each of them is a complete, cheap, one-day copy of you. It has no rights. You're the only one of you that has rights. But you can send it out into the world to go to the library to study if you bought a high quality model. The green models have to do all the chores that keep you busy every day. And it's a real thought experiment about human personality, because there's so many different personalities who wouldn't cooperate with themselves.
Right.
And you might be the sort who would, in which case you come off the table and you say, look at your hand and you say, oh man, I'm the green one today. I got to do all the crap work. And if you do everything well, you come back and your memories are uploaded back into the original person. So you have been in many places in a single day. You've gotten everything done that you needed done that day. And the resulting society is way fun. It's been called one of my most fun novels. Terrible puns. But the last quarter of it explores some of the same territory that Heinlein does at the end of Beyond This Horizon. What is beyond what we see? I mean, I have a science of solistics in this novel, where you imprint not only your memories, but your soul into these clay figures, as God did in the clay that he used to make Adam, as the terracotta soldiers of Xi'an supposedly had each the soul of a different soldier, the Golem of Prague. But in the end, this one brilliant researcher is taking it beyond this horizon, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I must take my leave of your senses. Only those of you over 60 can get the joke that I just made, but that's okay. You understand that I'm wishing you all success in a civilization that keeps getting brighter and better.
Perfect. So before we sign off, David, I know you have to run. Where can people find you?
Well, I've supplied a bunch of links, and davidbryn.com is the next one. And I also have a popular blog that makes weekly commentaries that alternate between science and commenting on our weird society. So,
perfect. All right. I'll make sure to put all those links in there. So, well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Whenever I reach out to someone, it's always a question of, am I ever going to hear back? Is it going to happen? And this coalesced pretty quickly. So I appreciate it.
You get a thumbs up into the camera, even if folks aren't seeing it. As a matter of fact, I'm giving two thumbs up to your audience. Stay citizens and loyal to an enlightenment.
Hey, I got a screenshot of it, so everyone can see it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, David.
Sure. Best of luck.
All right. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Mr. David Bryn. I thought it was a lot of fun talking to him. Kind of went all over the place, bounced around the book a little bit here and there. We didn't really have the traditional kind of non-spoiler and spoiler discussion, but I think if you get somebody like David Bryn on your podcast, you want to just unleash him, and that's what we did here. So shout out to Olav from the Hugo Book Club, who recommended David for this title, and thanks to David and his publicist for getting back to me and making it happen. I do want to let folks know I actually have all of my future episodes of the main project of this podcast booked. So I have guests for all the remaining titles, and I am deep into starting to plan the continuing adventures of this podcast after I finish the list. So in due course, you'll hear about what we're going to do there. So in the meantime, if you want to support this podcast, you can leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast, share stuff on social media, tweet at me at Hugo's Podcast, or shoot me any feedback you want to, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form on the website, message me on Twitter, all that kind of stuff. You can get a hold of me in a variety of ways. And if you want to support financially the work that I do here and on my other podcasting, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up there. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. So thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.